My name is Rudy Kelly, and I am an Aboriginal.
I am Chief.
My dad was a great chief of the Tsimshian Nation, beloved by his people. But at home, with his family, he brought anger and pain. He told me that to succeed, I would have to leave everything behind. Now I'm on a journey to find out who and what my dad really was. The Aboriginal is an all-new CBC podcast. Available now.
This is a CBC podcast.
That is the sound of Niagara Falls, a popular tourist destination. And a main attraction here? A 20-minute boat ride that brings 600 blue plastic ponchoed people up close and personal to those thundering falls. One of the most popular fleets is the Maid of the Mist. The name comes from an often-told legend about an indigenous virgin maiden sacrificed yearly to the god of the falls. But this version didn't make sense to Rick Hill. The Tuscarora Elder tells a very different story of the Maid of the Mist.
There was a woman who became very distraught because one day she was down by the falls, she fell asleep, the snake slid up inside of her body, and she wasn't aware of that. Well then, when she finally married on their honeymoon, that snake bit her new husband, who passed away. Same thing happened a couple other times. So you can imagine she felt cursed. The only way to end it was to take her own life, so she jumped in the canoe, went over the brink of the falls. Behind the falls lived the Thunderbeings. These are the spirits that carry their bows and their arrows that turn into lightning bolts. Their job is to chase down those serpents. They saw what happened. So when she went over the brink of the falls, they reached out and grabbed her, brought her back behind there in what they call the Cave of the Winds. And they explained to her, it wasn't your fault. There's something inside you that we have to help you get rid of. So they made a fire, told her to stand over it. No matter what happens, don't move. And then lo and behold, this huge snake came falling out of her body. It was huge. As soon as it came out, then all of the Thunderbeings jumped on it, chopped it up because that's their favorite meal. So I like this story because it talks about the Thunderbeings behind the falls, the source of power and energy and spirit. Unfortunately, when all of the tourists started showing up, they decided to leave. They headed off and they live in the Rocky Mountains, but they still come back every spring. With climate change, sometimes it's the middle of the winter, but we hear their thundering voices.
That's Rick Hill sharing the story of the Maid of the Mist. He learned it from Chief Corbett Sundown of the Tonawanda Seneca Nation. It's just one of the many stories of this place. The traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, the Seneca, Cayuga, Oneida, Onondaga, Mohawk, and Tuscarora. Their ancestors witnessed the birth of the falls 12,000 years ago. It's generally believed that Niagara is a derivative of the Iroquoian word Angiera, meaning the strait. And Rick Hill is one of the people who are restoring the real history of Niagara Falls. Danse, Anine, Bujou, hello, and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Niagara Falls is a group of three waterfalls that spans the border between Ontario in Canada and New York in the United States. Thousands of people visit daily to see the awesome power of 168,000 cubic meters of water bursting over the crest line every single minute. That's like 62 Olympic-sized swimming pools. But the wonder of the falls goes far beyond that. Many of its mysteries are held in the stories of the indigenous peoples of this territory. Tim Johnson ensures the true history of this place is reflected through public art installations.
If you provide the information, if you find ways to deliver it, it definitely has an impact.
Generations of Rosemary Hills family sold their unique beadwork at the falls. It's a legacy the Tuscarora beadworker is passing on to her descendants.
And I want them to remember I'm Tuscarora.
They need to preserve their heritage in some way.
Rick Hill is on a lifelong quest to dispel the many myths of the falls and finally close the book on the false narratives of his people.
It catered to a kind of an old romanticized notion about Native people, but it just didn't make sense to us.
Today, the second in our travel series, Unmapped, grab your paddle and get in our canoe. We're going to unmap Ungierra, a.k.a. Niagara Falls. Earlier this spring, we sent Unreserved producer Rhiannon Johnson on a road trip.
Is this a stop for me?
With a little help from Siri, she made her way through the Niagara region in southern Ontario to Niagara Falls. The falls are part of the Great Lakes Basin and straddle the U.S.-Canada border.
And here's the border.
And all that water? Lake Erie is basically dumping itself into Lake Ontario by way of the Niagara River. The result is a true ecological wonder. We'll catch up to Ree and Siri in a bit, but first, let's get back to that story we heard at the beginning of the show. The one from Rick Hill about the Maid of the Mist. Rick is from Grand Island, New York. It's just south of the falls on the U.S. side. Growing up, he heard a lot of fanciful stories connecting Indigenous people to the falls. Stories, he says, never felt right to him.
I don't know when it began, but a myth was created that somehow the local Native people would sacrifice a beautiful maiden to the spirit of the falls every year. And so then around that was concocted all of these legends about kind of like the evil spirits that lived behind the falls. Sacrificing this woman would somehow bring a blessing to those being alive. It catered to a kind of an old romanticized notion about Native people, but it just didn't make sense to us. And so that's what got me started to say, I wonder what the real story is.
And what was troubling about that version of the story for you?
Well, it just didn't make sense knowing the nature of our people and how we feel about the sacredness of life. And we have ceremonies to take care of both the positive and negative forces of life. And human sacrifice was not part of our tradition.
Mm. And who is telling this story to tourists?
As far as I can see, it probably began about 1830. Many tourists began to come to Niagara Falls after the War of 1812. And I think it's the power of the falls. There's something very seductive about it. There is something that almost makes you want to jump in just to see what it would be like to go over the brink, of course, to your death. So the falls, death, honeymoons, they all got tied together somehow. And because of the mist that's created, and you see a rainbow in the mist, it was like a natural place for storytelling to be born, mm-hmm. combined with all of the stereotypes that the tourists brought with them, and then a few overly romanticized accounts, then a new legend's born.
And presumably it was non-Indigenous people telling this version.
Yes, but you know, one of the things about our people too is we did kind of have a nasty habit of keeping the true stories to ourselves and just telling the visitor, the anthropologist, the scholar, whatever, you know, a fanciful tale, especially if they're offering a few dollars for that. So who knows how it began, but we certainly were living the consequence of it when I was a child.
Mm. What did it take for you to learn the true story of the Maid of the Mist?
Well, I remember one time they used to have a Maid of the Mist beauty pageant in Niagara Falls, New York. And we went down there and we noticed that, you know, there were all non-natives being dressed up like natives. And it kind of spurred me on because we raised a protest about this, that it wasn't appropriate. This had to be about, I don't know, 1978 or so. And it was the mayor of Niagara Falls who had been adopted by the Tuscaroras years earlier. He said, so what's the real story? And I kind of looked around at my friends and said, well, we'll get back to you on that. And so we tried to find out as best we could. We looked in the literature. We finally then tracked down an old Seneca man at the Tonawanda Nation near Akron, New York. he was a little reluctant. His name was Corbett Sundown, but he finally told us this story, the real story of what took place. And then I could see why it would be a difficult story to kind of share in public because of the power of the story.
And what do you mean by that? What was the power of the story?
Well, there were two things. It really was a story not about the maid or the young woman, but it was about an older woman who got jealous of her. This woman, they were down picking medicine plants down by the falls. She fell asleep on a nice warm day, and a snake came slithering up between her legs. The old woman saw that, but because she was jealous of how beautiful this young woman was, she didn't tell anybody. That snake slid right inside that young woman. She didn't know it. So when she got up, she was carrying that snake inside of her. Anyway, that snake had to be expelled, and that's what the real Thunder Beings, those that do live behind the falls, they helped her do that, performed a ceremony for her. And then when she returned to her village, that old woman was kind of like, her hair was all messed up, her clothes were all dirty, and she was just wandering around screaming things. She had gone crazy. Proposed husbands of this beautiful woman passed away, because you can imagine on their honeymoon, they were expecting big things. They weren't expecting a big snake to bite the husband who died from the wound. So the old lady really drove herself crazy by wishing she had told the truth.
Mm. And what does this story teach us?
I think it's a lot about that vanity, about how, you know, some of us are good looking, some medium looking, and some not so good looking. And we're not supposed to judge one another. We're not supposed to say, I'm better looking than you, and therefore I deserve more. And that we're supposed to help one another. Particularly, you know, we talk about female mentoring and this kind of the idea of the old woman should have helped that young girl understand something was wrong and helped her deal with the issue. But in her jealousy, she kind of let it go, and the consequence was the loss of a human life. So sometimes you think about that when you see somebody doing something that, you know, maybe they shouldn't be doing, or they maybe don't understand the consequences. How do you help them cope with that, rather than just get angry at them or just get quiet about what you see?
Mm. You mentioned earlier the Thunder Beings and how they played a role in healing her. What is the significance of the Thunder Beings?
Well, we don't know when, but when the world was made new, these Thunder Beings were assigned a duty, because in our world, there's a huge serpent under the water, under the Great Lakes. And that serpent has an insatiable appetite for humans. Keeps coming, rising up to the surface now and then. The Thunder Beings' job is to grab that rainbow bow and then shoot their arrows, which become into like a lightning bolt, to strike and keep those serpents away from humans. So they were already doing that job when this woman got, when the snakes slid up inside of her. So she did try to commit suicide because she felt so bad. The Thunder Beings rescued her as she was going over the falls. And they said, you know, what happened to you is not your fault. Here, we're going to perform this ceremony. We'll help you you recover. But just that idea that the spirit forces look after us, not only metaphysically, but in this case, in a real thing. They actually reached out, brought her behind the falls, and performed the ceremony.
Mm. And what do you like about this version of the story?
Well, understanding and that there's a kind of world above where the eagles and the thunderbirds and the thunder beings are, and there's a world below where big creatures, big slimy, creepy things crawl. Humans hang in the balance, which is why they always used to say, it's a little dangerous to be in a canoe, because you're right in the middle between those realms. So you got to make sure you've done your protective ceremonies, you carry medicine with you, that you have a good mind to get you across that water. When the waters start to get a little rough, as they are down by the rapids there, that means that serpent is coming up. So I think about that a lot, that this, let's just say, this cosmic battle between the goodness of the thunder beings, the thunderbirds, and then the destructive power of those huge serpents. Some people believe it's like an underwater panther with a long tail, or a huge snake with antlers or horns. I think it also helps to dispel this notion that this was like a pristine, beautiful world, like everything was groovy from a long time ago. But in our case, this drama was set up between these two forces. All the Creator asked us to do was to be thankful and to use a good mind in making the choices that we face. And so to me, that's a great story to think about. Every time you're facing adversity or something troubling or facing COVID. You have to still use a good mind, good indigenous mind, to figure out what you're going to do about that.
Mm. Why is it important for you to have learned and to know the real story behind the what was thought to be the real story?
I had been on my own personal quest to understand myself better as a Haudenosaunee, a person of the longhouse. What does it mean to be me? And how come I don't know these things? So as I began to explore the archives and museums, the art world, and meeting with old people, I began to realize it's almost like there's a parallel world to how I existed. And that parallel world has that old ancestral knowledge, that old experience and dealing with all of the creatures of the universe. And I wanted to know that. I wanted to know, what is our relationship to that? Because I had to believe there's something more than just making money. And so in looking at that, finding these stories, and since then, I've probably uncovered over 700 of our stories that are just truly amazing. Some of them are gory, as you can imagine. But when you listen to it, or you think about it, and you're reflecting on what's happening to you, you'll find meaning in that story to help you make the decisions you need to.
Mm. And now that you've reclaimed that story and many others about the people who used to, you know, live and thrive in that territory, why do you think it's important to then pass it on to others?
Well, just like I had to kind of squeeze it out of this old man. He didn't want to tell the story at first. And I said, no, I said, we got to know. You have a responsibility to pass it on. Somebody told you, now you have to tell somebody. And here we are. And so I realized that's the way our cultures always work. Somebody told a story about something, and that either became a ceremony or became a way of being. It came a way forward. There's an inspiration in there. There's a challenge to kind of live your life in an indigenous way or a Haudenosaunee way. And so I like harvesting those ideas and say, how are we going to apply them today? Because we don't live like our ancestors did. You know, I don't know. I looked around. I don't think I'm ever going to meet the Thunderbeings and shake their hand. But it's through the story I can imagine how real they are.
Mm. And as we move through the episode today, we're going to be talking about, you know, Indigenous people in the area who are reclaiming these stories, returning them to, you know, the overall education about the place. How do you think that our stories as Indigenous people, as Haudenosaunee, as Tuscarora, how can we help to reshape how a person understands a place like Niagara Falls?
Well, I think it's beginning to happen because as the larger society is facing an environmental holocaust and climate change, they're desperate to look for what's the alternative. Well, that alternative has always been there, that parallel world, that ancient knowledge about how to live in harmony with what's there, or to be compatible to what's there. So I think that our stories can fuel a whole another generation of thinking, both on our side and on the other side, to say, are we living with the land? Are we living with the trees, with the water, with the unseen spirits? Are we living with them well enough that lives in the future will continue? So you could call this the seventh generation philosophy. What are we going to do today that'll help make sure that that future generation is going to be born into a world that's healthy and they can find the best way to fulfill themselves? Well, we got to do that work. Part of that now is dismantling the harm that these myths and stereotypes have done, but we have to be the viable alternative. We have to be the living example then of what's right.
Rick, thank you so much for your time and for your storytelling today.
Well, it's my pleasure. And now that I told you, pass it on.
Oh, I got a whole radio audience that's going to be passed on to.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Or as we say, Nyawa.
Igwasani. Rick Hill is a Tuscarora elder and knowledge holder. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, we explore Niagara Falls, led by Indigenous guides sharing Indigenous history. Let's check back in with our producer, Rhiannon.
All right, found it.
She made it to Queenston Heights Park.
Now entering Queenston Heights.
The park is an important stop on the tourist trail. It's about 10 kilometers from the falls themselves and a short hike up a ridge.
Wow.
It's a gorgeous view steeped in history. This is the birthplace of the iconic Niagara Falls, It's also the site of the first epic battle on these lands, the War of 1812. Today, that battle is commemorated by the Landscape of Nations Memorial.
One provides a key to all the various elements that are here.
The Landscape of Nations Memorial is dedicated to the Haudenosaunee Confederacy and Indigenous allies who fought in the War of 1812.
Good panel as well.
Okay.
Ree met up with Tim Johnson and Jim Hill to learn more.
We are standing at the entrance to the Landscape of Nations Memorial, what I call the entrance experience. You know, how you enter an exhibition in a space like this is very important. And so we have several elements here that are visually on display. One, the symbol of the turtle as the earth. Not only that, though, but it gives us the direction to proceed upon, leading towards this granite pavers that reflects the two-row wampum belt. We're standing on ground where the Niagara Falls just started right over here, right in Queenston area. And some 12,500 years ago, but we know from the archaeological evidence that Indigenous peoples were in this general region 13,000 years ago. So that means that Indigenous peoples actually were most likely present and witnesses to the birth of Niagara Falls and have been here ever since.
Yeah.
To its, you know, through all of that time through to its current location. So it's really kind of a powerful timeline marker, indicator of Indigenous presence here in Niagara. As we come up this slight elevation here and past this sort of time marker of 1812, the war, and all of that, we come to the center part of the memorial, which is the memory circle. That means never forget in the Mohawk language, which you're seeing right there.
Can I get you to say that?
Unfortunately, no.
Hi, I'm Phelan Johnson.
And I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and we look at history a bit differently. Have you ever wondered how hundreds of wild horses came to inhabit an island in the Atlantic Ocean?
Or what Lord of the Rings and a small town in Manitoba have in common? Or the burning question, did Canada invent the teen drama?
The Secret Life of Canada is a podcast about the country you know and the stories you don't. New episodes available now wherever you get your podcasts.
After hearing about Ree's tour of the Landscape of Nations Memorial, we couldn't wait to dig into more of the rich history of that place. And so we asked Tim Johnson if he'd tell us a little more. Tim is the senior advisor to the Heritage and Legacy Group at the Niagara Parks Commission. He is Mohawk from Six Nations. Tim, welcome to Unreserved. After hearing about Ree's tour of the Landscape of Nations Memorial, we couldn't wait to dig into more of the rich history of that place. And so we asked Tim Johnson if he'd tell us a little more. Tim is the senior advisor to the Heritage and Legacy Group at the Niagara Parks Commission. He is Mohawk from Six Nations. Tim, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
We just heard a bit of the tour you gave our producer, Rhiannon. What is the Landscape of Nations Memorial?
The Landscape of Nations Memorial is a public artwork display exhibition that really honors and recognizes the contributions and sacrifices that Indigenous nations made as allies to the Crown during the War of 1812. This is a part of a history that has been underrepresented for many years, and so many parties and participants got involved in the Niagara region to develop this particular public artwork.
And can you describe it a little bit for me?
It sits on the highest point of Queenston Heights, which strategically was very important for a variety of reasons, particularly during the War of 1812, where you held the high ground. And so, this was under British control. Then, of course, the War of 1812 started. America declared war on Britain. And one of the first epic battles was the Battle of Queenston Heights, as American forces sought to capture that high ground. And so that was October 13, 1812, when that happened. And of course, a big part of the story is that the arrival of indigenous forces joining that battle turned the tide of the battle towards a victory for Great Britain and the Allies.
Mm. Well, let's hear a clip from the tour that you did with Rhiannon and your colleague Jim Hill. Took a minute to share the story of John Norton. Let's have a listen to that.
Probably the best history we have of what happens here in Niagara during the War of 1812 comes from John Norton, or Tanen Hogeroen. So he leads the Grand River Warriors that fight here. And for quite a few hours, there are no British or Canadian guys fighting. It is all native warriors holding off an American army. They basically turn the American flank, keep them occupied for hours, reconnect with British and Canadian guys who are further up river at Niagara Falls, and they sort of hold the line here. And to the credit of all the British and Canadian guys, they do come back. They don't just run away. They do come back and win the battle. So he leaves us with his journal that really explains the experience from the perspective of the men from Grand River through all of this.
Mm. I see you shaking your nodding your head there. What do you love about this story?
To understand the commitment that the Six Nations had to the Crown is really important, because relations began generations before the War of 1812. In fact, there was a significant gathering in 1764 in the Niagara area called the Treaty of Niagara. British leadership met with some 24 indigenous nations to establish treaties, to renew relationships, to adjust relationships. A lot of negotiation took place. But this is one of the things that makes the Niagara region so powerful and historic with respect to the involvement of indigenous peoples with Great Britain. And so a couple generations later, the War of 1812 arrives, and those allies are still there. They're still in conversation. They're still have relations, and so they were activated. With leaders like John Norton and John Brandt, they were really living out their understanding of their relationship as allies to the Crown, not as subjects, not as wards, but as people who are self-empowered, who have agency, who make their own decisions, and join that war on the side of Great Britain. That's what's so important about this. This is not just a history lesson for Niagara, it's a history lesson for the entire country.
Mm, absolutely. How different could history have played out if it weren't for, you know, the indigenous allies in the war?
Well, most historians have reached consensus on this question. And their answer is that were it not for the participation of indigenous nations as allies during the War of 1812, Canada would very likely have been absorbed into the United States.
Wow, that's a pretty stark understanding of how important this particular piece of history is.
Yeah, and when you study the battles and understand the role that indigenous forces played, it becomes very real for you.
Hmm. What was the strength in those indigenous nations that played a role? Was it strictly numbers? Was it tactics? Was it a mixture of both?
Yeah, I think it was a mixture, you know, and it wasn't necessarily easy to recruit forces from indigenous nations to fight. But again, because of these long-standing relations, enough forces were raised to make a difference in many of these conflicts and battles that took place. Not only that, but certainly for the Six Nations, the Haudenosaunee, who had allied with Great Britain during the American Revolution, you know, they were fearful of being attacked again and overrun yet again by the Americans. And so you know, a lot of strategic choices had to be made. But it was the forces and also the tactics. So the way in which the indigenous soldiers sort of lined up, well, they didn't really line up. You know, they were moving targets. They were hard to hit. They were behind trees. They were more of a guerrilla type of force. And that made a huge difference, particularly at the Battle of Queenston Heights, in holding off the American invasion.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about the region itself and the indigenous nations that occupied that area. Who were they?
Well, at the time of contact with Europeans in the 1600s, the earlier 1600s, the mid-1600s, it was the Neutral Nation, a group of Iroquoian-speaking peoples. But trade wars over the beaver and other things that emerged after European contact led to their dispersal. By the 1650s, the Neutral Nation wasn't there, but the Seneca Nation was, as part of the Haudenosaunee, and others as well. Anishinaabeg nations also came into the area, Mississauga, and others. So it's been an interesting sort of region, and it depends on what timeline you look at as to which indigenous people was predominant in the area at the time.
Mm. And how does Queenston Heights Park fit into that, you know, to that broader landscape and region?
It's right there at Queenston Heights where Niagara Falls began. So that's where the falls first crested some 12,500 years ago. However, there's evidence of indigenous peoples in the archaeological record of our people having been there some 13,000 years ago. Testing on a blood sample on tools that were used to kill woolly mammoths, and it dates back 13,000 years. So we know that indigenous peoples were right on the crest of the ice. As the ice receded, our people were there. And that, as a result, when you connect these two things, then you realize that, oh my goodness, indigenous people very likely witnessed the birth of Niagara Falls. Incredible,
wow.
Right?
That is incredible. What a moment to see. Oh, I guess it wasn't a moment per se. But
I'm sure somebody saw it at some point. You know, maybe not the exact instance or moment, but very early in the life of Niagara Falls, it was witnessed by indigenous people.
There's been a lot of work done to, you know, acknowledge this history, indigenous history of that area over the last 20 years. Can you tell me about some of that work?
There's been, in addition to the Landscape of Nations Memorial, another memorial at the other end of where Lower Secord's trek terminated, in Thorold at the Q House, there is what's called the First Nations Peace Monument. And this is another project we were involved with. And that involved world-renowned architect Douglas Cardinal. So he designed that memorial. But again, it's also related to the War of 1812 history. In other areas as well, there are communities, municipalities working on projects and developing parks in coordination and partnership with indigenous peoples. There's one going in, expected for later in 2025 in the town of Lincoln. There's another one that's just emerging, getting rolling in the town of Fort Erie. And so a lot's happened. And in addition to that, the Niagara Park system that runs along the Niagara River corridor all the way from Fort Erie north to Niagara on the Lake, they've included a lot of information in their interpretive centers, on signage, on displays in their facilities about the indigenous history of the region. So it's an area that's very much alive in terms of trying to create this full view of the history and the importance of indigenous peoples in that history in the area.
Hmm. Why do you think memorials are a good way to share that history of the area?
They're much more powerful and effective than words on a history book, in a history book. And we've seen this because I was just touring a group of 90 international sustainable tourism students from Niagara College through Landscape of Nations just yesterday.
Hmm.
And it becomes a destination. So it's one thing to have the sort of the recording of this in a history book or on your computer screen. It's another to go there. there's something about place-based learning that makes it really much more effective and important for people. And so you start with just a, you know, just a plot of land. When you put a memorial in, it becomes something altogether different, and it's treated differently, right? And there is a real sense of reverence and respect at the Landscape of Nations Memorial. You know, people come there to pay their respects for the indigenous forces who sacrificed and died on the heights. And it takes on a whole new meaning. And it's really remarkable to see that transformation at each of these sites. At the First Nations Peace Monument in Thorold, after there was the news of the 215 children's remains found in the residential school there, I think it was at Kamloops, all of a sudden that memorial was just overrun with mementos and little children's shoes and teddy bears and all kinds of things, where people actually then came to that particular memorial to pay their respects for what happened. So it's remarkable. You create a space, you apply some artistic creativity to it, and it generates a whole new reality. But the physicality of these locations greatly enhances place-based learning.
Mm. Of course, Niagara Falls is, you know, famous world round, you know. But what do you find that most tourists think of Niagara Falls when they first arrive?
Well, that's part of what we're working to do is to move beyond just the tourist moment, right? Go see Niagara Falls, and then you run off from there and say you saw the falls. But what we've been doing at Niagara Parks is really trying to add more depth and understanding, right, to make that experience even more important.
Have you yourself witnessed, you know, a change, you know, when people first arrive and they're like, "Whoa, those are big falls," and then as you walk through and educate them about what's actually happened here, do you see a change?
Yeah, well, we put together a tour called the Indigenous Niagara Heritage and Legacy Tour. Mm-hmm. And so we can tell you firsthand that folks coming in who know very little about Indigenous history and the connection between Indigenous peoples and Niagara Falls, by the time they're done with that tour, they've traveled a considerable distance between not knowing and then having a lot of fulsome contextual, factual information, historical information about Indigenous peoples in the region and what that experience has been over some 13,000 years. So yeah, if you provide the information, if you find ways to deliver it, it definitely has an impact.
Mm. Why is it important for you personally to make sure that people are educated about the Indigenous history and involvement in creating our country?
I retired from senior management at the Smithsonian Institution in 2015. And my goal was to come back to my community here at Six Nations and to the region where we have been historically active and work on sort of legacy projects that way. My seventh great grandfather was Joseph Brant, the famous Mohawk leader whose son John Brant fought at the Battle of Queenston Heights. And his footsteps, Joseph Brant's footsteps, and of course his son's John Brant, are all over the Niagara region. They were everywhere in that area, on both sides of the border. It just seemed natural for me to want to kind of retrace some of those footsteps and make a contribution.
That is so cool, Tim.
Yeah.
What do you think he would say to you, you know, having helped build this legacy and return this history?
I don't know. He was such a substantial figure.
Yeah.
Nobody can really over or outdo Joseph Brant, really, in some ways. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, was one of the players who had a significant role in shaping history.
Yeah. And what do you hope that people will take away after they've, you know, visited Niagara and learned this history?
Well, we've seen the changes. It's really interesting because we've worked very closely with civic leadership, right? Mayors and councilors of the municipalities in the Niagara region. And we've seen in several instances where people had little to no knowledge of anything to do with Indigenous peoples to becoming real champions of Indigenous peoples. So this is what happens when you provide information to people. And when you work towards the education of the general population, and particularly of leadership, if they are so equipped, they will take that on board, and then we believe make appropriate choices going forward, right? So, you know, one of the things that we see from the period of the War of 1812 to where things went off the rails is that leading into the War of 1812, indigenous nations still had agency, and they were treated as nations by the crown, right? About the 1830s, that history starts to shift towards this, racialized process of converting indigenous peoples to wards of the nation state. So we get a series of, bad policies and treaties and things that take place because of that warped framework that people had. So, what we need to get back to a point in which indigenous nations are treated as nations, they're seen as governments governing their people, and that the protocols that used to be in place need to be returned. And so I think there's a big lesson, not only for understanding history better, but looking for tools that apply to truth and reconciliation today. So, so I think there's a lot to learn going forward, and that's what we hope for.
Tim, thank you so much for your time and your knowledge today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Tim Johnson is the senior advisor to the Heritage and Legacy Group at the Niagara Parks Commission. He is Mohawk from Six Nations. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, Unmapped Niagara Falls. After the War of 1812, tourism really took off in Niagara Falls. That meant business was booming, in particular, the business of beadwork. On the U.S. side of the falls, generations of Tuscarora women set up shop along the pathways leading towards the falls. Dozens of families would display their work in a patchwork of tables and blankets. As tourism flourished, so did the sale of Tuscarora beadwork. Small, intricate beaded souvenirs like birds, flowers, and little bags called whimsies were popular. The sales from their work supported families and kept the tradition of Tuscarora beadwork strong. The beadwork is specific to the people here, and it's what Rosemary Hill is teaching her great-granddaughter.
Thank you.
I stay.
Okay.
I keep my coat up.
Oh, you can leave it on. It's okay. Are you too hot?
Rosemary's home on the Tuscarora Reservation was a special stop on Rhiannon's trip to the region.
Okay, well, you want to go put your coat over there. All right. I'm trying to talk to the lady now, okay?
Generations of Rosemary's family sold their wares at the falls. It's an important part of her family's legacy.
My early memories of beading was like my mother used to do the Boy Scouts here on the reservation. So she would take small things that she had learned from my father's aunt, and it would be my great aunt and her grandmother and her mother, very small things that she had learned to make from them, and she would teach the boys. So then that's where I sat at the table and watched and learned. Right there was my beginning. They did loom work, they did some of the raised beadwork, they used to make brooches, they made bracelets, they made armbands. She said she'd be hollering at us, "You got to learn how to bead, because as long as you know you're beading, you'll be able to take care of yourself and you'll never starve." She said this, And that was true, because I always remember her beading for other people because they were going somewhere and they needed beadwork and they'd buy it from her. So that was her big thing, was to make sure we knew beadwork so we would never starve. Tuscarora beadwork is a form of raised beadwork, which is raised in a couple ways. Some are beads over beads over beads. Some are small beads over large beads, large beads over... It's just a layer of beading of beads. But it's a unique form, and went back to find out where it come from, because all I had was what my family told me. our grannies used to always talk about how they had to fight sometimes for their spots at Niagara Falls. Niagara Falls, they was a big beating place for the Tuscaroras because the Tuscaroras had hidden General Parker from the British in the War of 1812. So the Tuscaroras were given the honor of being able to sell their wares at the brink of the falls, it was called. And so they had given them the right to go there and sell just the Tuscaroras. But as we are Six Nations, we have friends in every nation and everything. And so they sometimes invited some of the other nations to come with them and sell. But after a while, I guess they were coming a little too much to sell, so they asked them to not come because there was other Tuscaroras that wanted to come. They didn't want to leave, so I guess they kept coming, and there was a big row, and they all got into a fight. And then the police were called, and it was shut down. Anyways, they lost it for a year, and then it was given back to them. But when it was given back to them, there was only a quota of people that could go set up and sell. Put your name in, fill your papers out. They picked so many out, and I think it was 10. I didn't start going till I was maybe seven or eight. I would go with my mother and my grandmother, my mother and her mother, and my great aunt on my father's side. And we all went up there. We didn't all go together. Me and my mother would go with my great aunt, Ellen, or we would go with my grandma, Hattie. We called her Gramsy. And then we used to go like almost every summer and do that. And then they changed it. The Robert Moses came in and we couldn't park where we used to park, where all the visitors park. They made us park on the streets. But we had to carry all our stuff and run across four lanes of traffic to get over to the park. And we had to climb over the railings they had put up. We had to climb over. We put all our tables. We had to carry everything. Tables, you know, our baskets and whatever full of items. And if we weren't out there at a certain time, they'd give us tickets. So there was always something. They always tried to put something in our way so we wouldn't want to go, you know. And then there was a time when hardly anyone went to the falls. It was in the early 90s, 1990s. It died out to the point that it wasn't being sold off the reservation, but it never died out on the reservation because we always made the beadwork we used. We always did our elaborate raised beadwork and everything, but we used it for gifts like birthdays, graduations, weddings. It was all used as gifts for each other because no one wanted to pay the price anymore. Beads got more expensive. The velvets were more expensive, and sometimes we couldn't even get them. I got married off, and I was away for a while here and there, and I would still bead, but not as much. Like, any one day I left him where he was and came home, and being home, I had noticed that we have a Miss Princess, Tuscarora Princess every year. They pick out a princess to represent. She used to have her own outfit. So I was going to put my little girl into the competition for the little girls. And I said to my cousin, I says, you know, I says, there's not hardly any beadwork on these outfits. I said, we used to have outfits with lots of beadwork and beautiful, I said, big raised pieces. So I start beading again. Everybody went crazy over the outfit. And one year I made her this butterfly outfit. And they were just amazed with it. So come Powell time, everybody had a butterfly outfit. I teach my own kids and grandkids and great-grands.
How about two beads?
I'll get you two. How about these pretty ones?
How about two?
One, two. One, two. Move your feet. Move your water over, please, so you don't spill it. Thank you, good girl. All right, you can bead.
How about four?
Oh, no, you can have one more, not four, but one more. So it's just very important to me. Yeah, I know the beadwork means a lot to all the Tuscaroras, especially Tuscarora women. Their past mothers and grandmothers have fought for it, too. It's something that's Tuscarora, and I wanted them to understand that they have Tuscarora in them, and they need to keep that and share that one day with their own children to keep it and save it. So, and I'm Tuscarora, and I want them to remember I'm Tuscarora. They need to preserve their heritage in some way. I tried language, forget it. I just could not get it. But that's what it is, to keep it and save it for generations after generations. That's where the importance is.
Rosemary Hill is an artist from the Tuscarora Reservation. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Rhiannon Johnson, Kim Kasher, Danielle Piper, Zoe Tennant, Elena Hudgens-Lyle, and Laura Bone-Stubing. Find more on our website at cbc.ca/unreserved. And if you check out our Facebook page, you can see a beautiful animation of Rick Hill's telling of The Maid of the Mist. Thanks to Brooke Schreiber for that video. As for this world traveler, I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Ganaskin the Mitten Owl. I just say.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.